to episode 139 of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other failed newspaper tycoons and successful newspaper tycoons as masterpieces. I am joined in meat space, as ever, by Roger, the
faithful friend, gets stabbed in the back at the end.
And I am Nick, the posthumous protagonist, is the word I was reaching for, of the podcast. And we have finally gotten round to the, open quotes, greatest film of all time, close quotes.
Certainly a lot of people seem to have said so.
Yes, maybe less so recently, I'm not sure. But we are talking about...
Well, people favour Hitchcock as well these days, after all.
So. Well, yeah, true. This is Orson Welles' masterpiece, the 1941 film, and one of his only, certainly the only one he did without significant studio interference, and probably based on how this went on, this is Citizen Kane.
And, yeah, I think it is fair to say up front that this is a film that has been very widely imitated, and in turn, that makes it look now unoriginal, because it originated a whole bunch of things that everybody else copied later.
Now, I think that is true on a technical perspective. Like, this is a film that is full of technical innovations, of zooming in and continuous shots, and like we have an opening shot in one part where we see like the neon sign, and then we zoom through the neon sign and down through a skylight to end up in a deserted restaurant. I mean, it is a, it's not really a noir film, but that, you know, the lighting, for instance, our protagonist, the reporter, whose name I forget because he's really just, he's not really much of a character in it.
He might be a protagonist in a technical sense, but he's basically there so that there is somebody to hang the story on.
Yes, and consequently, in case you're in any doubt as to whether he's supposed to be someone you pay any attention to, he's never, his face is basically never shown. He's always in shadow. Even when the other characters are well lit up, he's wearing a hat. It just happens to be covering his face. You can see he's wearing glasses. You get an impression of him. And that's an interesting technique. I mean, as far as the story, I suppose it is. It's a tragedy. It's a biopic.
It's a hatchet job.
It's an exploration of.
It was certainly perceived by its target as a hatchet job.
Well, alleged target. I'll slightly take issue with that, because I'm not sure a biopic's been done quite like this before or since, especially. Maybe it has, maybe I've missed others. But and it is a biopic. It's the story of Charles Foster Kane, who is a...
newspaper magnate, everything else magnate.
He's made incredibly rich at a very young age by a gold mine and a deed that happens to come over to him. And the wealth that flows from the gold mine allows him to buy a newspaper. It's not quite clear whether the newspaper makes... It's not really what makes him the money, but it certainly becomes incredibly successful.
The impression I get when they're doing the here is where his money came from stuff at the beginning, the notice of his death, in effect, because this whole thing is happening in flash. But they definitely mention the gold mine as the source of his wealth, whether other things made money as well. I mean, one of the things about being very rich is that you can buy things that will simply make you more money. So.
Yes. And in fact, interest. So we start the film with this news on the march, this cinema reel, which basically tells you the entire story of the film from beginning to end in the first few minutes.
But it's the publicly acceptable version.
Exactly.
Here is the great man.
But even then, you know, it's clear that some contract... We see that he's a conflicted figure. You know, even in the opening newsreel, he's described by different people as a communist or a fascist. I forget the actual terms, but basically he's described as extreme left and extreme right. pretty early on. We even have the kind of mystery set up as to what his final word is, which is Rosebud, one of the great cinematic mysteries of all time, in the sense that the mystery of the whole film is to unlock what his final word was, which is Rosebud.
Yeah, though I think it is fair to say that this is mostly an excuse to hang the film on. I mean, it's what's motivating the reporter. Everybody's obviously doing their pieces on the great man is dead.
Yes.
And his editor is looking for a new angle.
So it's fair to say it's what Hitchcock might have called a MacGuffin. It drives the film. The whole film then is set up. We have, and I think you'd be, so the opening is fairly standard cinema. The opening is actually Kane's death and his final word, and this extreme close up of his mouth, and then the smashing of the snow globe. But then we have the newsreel. But from then, I am not very sensitive to cinematography in some ways, in that it's a bit like a soundtrack to me. I notice it if I'm supposed to. Otherwise, I'm just drawn in by the story. And I'll be honest. So I'm aware Kane is cinematograph. I always struggle with that word. But visually, it's doing a lot of new things. Mm. It's very dramatic. And in some ways, being a child of modern cinema, I don't notice them so much. In fact, that's the thing that I only notice on repeat watches. And this is probably my third, fourth, maybe fifth watch of Citizen Kane. And then I start looking at the cinematography because I know the story. But the first time I watched it, I am genuinely drawn in by the story and the characters. And so I don't notice that stuff so much on first watch. Mm.
I think the thing that was really, from a cinematographic point of view, the thing that was really revolutionary at the time was, one of them was deep focus. As yes. in, we will have the guy in the foreground and we will have the stuff in the background in focus at the same time.
Yes.
Which, for physics reasons, means you need a small aperture, which in turn means you need lots and lots of light.
Now, I've read that this is, Wells was at this point a rising star of theatre because he'd just done, amongst many other things, the War of the Worlds production, which was supposed to have caused mass panic across America.
This story appears, in retrospect, largely to have been circulated by him.
which
is a very Orson Welles thing to do.
Yes, how much actual mass panic there was is debatable. It did cause some consternation, but then may have been somewhat inflated. But he was given, so it was a big thing that Orson Welles was coming to Hollywood, and he was given basically, well, not quite a blank check, but a creative blank check.
It's that classic thing, you know, you've done a thing that was hugely popular, therefore we will let you off the lead for the next one.
Yes.
If you do a thing that's a failure, we will make you make something that we've already got fully scripted and produced, and you just turn the handle.
Yes. And again, in classic fashion, he was supposed to be allowed to do this for his first two pictures. He wasn't allowed to do it for his first two pictures, because after this, he was never allowed off the leash again, which is a shame, I think. The closest he came was The Magnificent Ambersons, but I guess we'll come on to that later. But
I would just like to hang on the other visual innovation, which really didn't work very well with the other thing, was because he wanted a lot of strange angles, particularly looking up people, the sets had to have ceilings.
Right, and that's hard with deep focus.
Normally the top of the set is where you put all the incredibly powerful lights.
Well, that was the lighting here is, I mentioned it, the point of mentioning Wells' theatre background is because, rather than come at this with, oh, I'm going to do this incredibly clever cinematographic thing, basically he didn't really know.
Yeah, Greg Toland is the in those days it was called the cinematographer.
Yes,
but what we would now call the director of photography. And as far as I can tell, and it's a bit tricky to tell at this remove, Wells said, "I want to do this," and Toland had to come up with a way of doing it.
But he liked a challenge. In fact, I think he requested to do this because he wanted something interesting to do. Consequently, so a lot of the light is natural light or different to a lot of lighting?
Well, outside certainly, but inside they have to build a set so that A, it has a ceiling and it exists in all the angles we're going to shoot it at, and at the same time we can get all the really bright lights in and keep them out of shot.
Okay. So it looks...
It reminds me of... what was that? That relatively late Kubrick film where he had the scene by candlelight, and there was one lens in the world that was able to do that, and he managed to get hold of it, that kind of thing.
It's that level of
technical innovation.
And consequently, I think at the time, it didn't really look like anything that had been done before.
Mm.
But now, I feel like that's what you're referring to in the sense, we can talk about the story, but in the sense that it doesn't look that innovative, it doesn't look that new now. In fact, some of it looks a little bit clunky, I think. Some of it doesn't quite work.
As I've said in different contexts, it's a bit like reading The Lord of the Rings when you've read a lot of other fantasy, because everything has copied The Lord of the Rings, more or less.
Yes.
Sometimes you chewed through D&D first. But you say, well, okay, yeah, I saw that done better in that other thing. Yeah, but this came first.
Yes, and the reason this exists is why the thing that you like exists. I feel bad, actually. You know, I don't want to be on the record saying Citizen Kane is clunky. It's not clunky. It's just, it's been, the things that it did have been polished and polished and polished so that I don't even notice them anymore, in a way.
There were times when I felt I could hear Wells in his splendid voice, which I cannot imitate well, saying, "Fie on your dramatic unities."
Well, that's the other thing. So narratively, it is quite...
Here's the thing you probably won't have noticed through a modern lens, which is it was the first film to make really heavy use of flashbacks. I mean, it wasn't the first film to have flashbacks. That had certainly been done, but it was the first one to make, say, a lot of them.
Yes, and we have talked about flashbacks. I mean, this entire film is flashback, and it's a patch. Well, that's not true. We have the modern strand of the reporter.
The framing story with the reporter, but yeah, it's mostly an excuse to have these vignettes of he talks to somebody or reads somebody's account, and we get the scene of what happened then.
Well, what I like... So, spoilers, I love Citizen Kane. So the problem with Citizen Kane, I think, or the problem Citizen Kane has, is that it has been renowned as the greatest film of all time for so long that...
Nothing's ever going to live up to that.
Yes, exactly. So when you come to watch it, you're bound to think, well, there's this other film that I like better. So, to me, I watched it relatively early in life, when I was aware it was very... And so... Actually, even at that stage, I was aware that something that was renowned as being the greatest film of all time probably wasn't going to be, so I was expecting it to be crap, perversely. Consequently...
Which is a good state to be in, because then when it's not rubbish, you're happy with it.
Yes, exactly, and that's how it worked for me, which is why I do like Kane, but I find it engrossing. Visually, it's a feast, and the reason I started off talking about the photography, which... Frankly, neither of us are that qualified to talk about. But it's very noirish in the literal sense of the lighting is quite noirish and quite dark.
Yeah, we've got a lot of the bars of the window shadowed on the opposite wall, that kind of thing.
Yes, and people are peculiar angles with the shadows over the effect. It makes heavy use of shadow and light. The story itself probably isn't really particularly noirish, but visually it is. So the story, as we have basically the rise and fall of this newspaper magnate, and so we're told in the opening newsreel that this man became rich at a young age, became heavily influential, owned one of the old, what they were called, yellow papers at the time. Is that right? Yellow paper? Or yellow news?
It's not completely clear whether it was one of those papers when he bought it.
he makes significant changes when he buys it, but he becomes...
Certainly, this is where it is reasonable to consider that there may be a particular target in mind, because he is pretty much regarded as having started the Spanish-American War.
So there were magnates, most notably William Randolph Hearst, who...
Actually did stop the Spanish-American War to sell papers.
Yes, and, Wells always said it was an amalgam of several people, and I think I think probably it was, partially because Kane is a slightly sympathetic figure, and if it was just about William Randolph Hearst, I don't think it would have been as sympathetic. Mm. Certainly Hearst thought it was about him, or got wind that it was about him, and was unhappy about it. But that, this is all kind of meta film, I suppose. So Kane becomes rich at a very young age, decides to buy a paper because he thinks it would be fun, and becomes this incredibly influential mogul.
Yeah, this is the thing that I've forgotten his name now, because we're doing this face-to-face, we don't have our usual Wikipedia immediately to hand. But yes. He's trustee/tutor. He's clearly
yes, the banker,
shocked
yes.
by the way he's turned out.
I thought it would be fun to run a newspaper, and Thatcher is his
yeah,
name.
Yeah.
And then we learn he kind of retires to this huge, custom-built, crumbling mansion called Xanadu in Florida.
Well, that's it takes a bit of time, but yeah.
Well, I think this is mentioned in the... in fact, the whole newsreel opens up within Xanadu, the couple of
oh, yeah.
And so we know all of this. We know he's just died. I think we even know his last name is Rosebud. We certainly know by the next scene. And so as he's dying, he utters this word, Rosebud. And people decide, well, this has got to be the key to this complicated man. This will explain everything. And so we have this reporter...
Or at the very least, this is going to be an angle that we can get for our paper that nobody else will have for their paper, because everybody is writing the standard platitudes.
Yes, exactly. So, yes, I'm being a bit disingenuous that they really believe that. But this, in fact, the reporter you sent on the quest isn't really... buying it either, but he then goes and interviews all the significant people in Kane's life, and that's where we get this, I think, cool kind of unreliable narrator thing. You never get anything from Kane's point of view himself, except I guess his death scene, but even that there's got to be someone watching. In fact, we find out someone was watching, but the way it's filmed, it looks like he's on his own.
Yes, that's where I said I can hear him saying phone or dramatic unities. This is very, very clear from the way it is filmed that there is nobody else in the room.
Yes.
And then the snow globe crashes and then the nurse comes in.
Yes.
There was nobody there until that point and he's already said it by then.
But we find
it
later
clear
in the film
other people clearly think that they heard those last words, and it's the same last word we heard. So
whether they were all gathered on the steps outside the drive, I think they were. Logically, you can square it, but I agree. It very much appears like he's on his own. But
you don't see it. That's my point. You don't see it happening. It is clear that we're not seeing the entire story.
Yes, so it sets up this idea that the perspectives that we're seeing are not necessarily reliable. I mean, basically everyone who he interviews, he doesn't interview his old mentor Thatcher, who is long since dead, but he goes to a memorial library and reads his journal, which triggers this flashback of how Kane, as a young child, inherits the deed to his this gold mine, and in fact his mother then signs him off. Rather than to be brought up by his biological parents, his own mother makes Kane himself like a trustee of the bank. So the bank brings him up. And that is, we learn, to get him away from an abusive father.
Would it be considered abusive by the standards of the day? Probably not, but at least an unpleasant one.
Yeah, I mean, it's clear he cares about him, but that doesn't mean he's not abusive. But then we get this series of interviews with Kane's old ex-best friend, Jebediah, Kane's ex... We never get an interview with the ex-first wife, I believe. There's his second wife.
I think she's regarded as having died.
I can't remember either. We also have his business, not quite his business partner, his kind of dog's body, the Baldrick to his Blackadder, whose name I've forgotten.
Leland?
Leland is his best friend. I was thinking more of the character played by Everett Sloan, who became a... I mean, the fascinating thing about Kane, one of the fascinating things, is these are almost all people who had never acted in movies before, including, in fact, the only alumnus we have on Ribbon of Memes is, of course, Joseph Cotton, who we talked about in The Third Man, which was, well, okay, I'm saying the only alumnus, of course, Orson Welles is in Third Man as well. And he was also in Gaslight. So we start to put these pieces of a jigsaw together of this man who is a contradiction. So he starts out young and idealistic and wants to... So he starts the paper and writes his Declaration of Independence.
Mm, these people are screwing over the common man. Let's get them, in effect. Which, of course, we... And not only do we know, but I think the audience at the time would have known that, yeah, that can be perfectly genuine, or it can be just rabble-rousing for your own end.
Yes.
And it's never really quite clear which of those things is happening.
Well, that's what
Though Thatcher is clearly very surprised because he said, hang on, you own some of these organisations that are screwing over the common man.
Yeah, but he's quite happy to then... There's a perverseness to Kane, which I quite like, which I think... It's fair to say William Randolph Hearst did not share, which is, yes, that he's quite happy to report on his own corrupt businesses. And it's brought to the fore particularly later on in the film when Kane has remarried and has basically built an entire opera house for his wife, who really is not a natural-born opera singer, and his friend Leland Jebediah... Is it Jebediah or Leland? I think it's both Jebediah and Leland. Writes a negative review, and Kane, this kind of perverse... this is the sort of thing I really like about the film, in that he's got this nature where he then finishes the negative review, publishes it, and then fires Leland, and then... But he sort of fires him, but also gives him a huge check to pay him off, much more generous than he needed to. I guess I'm dancing around. I love the complicatedness of the characters. I love that Kane is hard to explain. I mean, in some ways, he's very human. He has very human failings. He's clearly narcissistic. He's clearly very vain and self-important. But he does seem to have a moral core. And I find it painful to watch that getting eroded through the film and to know...
Blocked by his own actions.
Yes.
And he just doesn't really notice until... All of a sudden, it's not entirely clear whether he ever fully realises, oh, hang on, other people do have feelings too.
Well, the way I read it is he does kind of know that he is eroded, which is why he will do things like publish the negative review, because he knows the truth really, but he's still pig-headed enough, narcissistic enough that he'll go ahead with it, but still want to punish himself by doing these... strange things like deliberately losing money, publishing the negative review, like reporting on his own businesses.
Some of it feels to me, I'm speculating here, this isn't in the film, but a bit like the addicts trying to recapture that first glory as high.
Yes.
You do the same thing again and it doesn't have the same effect, so you do something more extreme.
Yes. I like my melancholy. And there is a heavy dose of melancholy. You know, the last parts of the film where he's basically wandering around this empty castle that he's built, I just find that, to me, my heart kind of reaches out to that kind of loneliness and hubris, even though he's absolutely brought it on himself.
Well, I think that's the point, that it is self-inflicted, and he knows it's self-inflicted.
Yes.
And he has enough self-awareness by then not to say, oh, well, you know, that woman done left me. It's, no, I drove her away. I made it impossible for her to stay.
Yes. Though I do find that scene where he's smashing up the... So his second wife eventually leaves him because she's... Funny enough, she's a young, extroverted woman. She doesn't want to sit around a castle, like, doing jigsaw puzzles. So she leaves him, and one of the very last scenes is him smashing the room up. I'm not sure the makeup quite holds up with that. I can see kind of the scalp wig and it just, unlike his lace.
Most of the time the edge makeup is very good indeed.
Yes, it is, genuinely, yes. Because all the characters, basically young people that have been made up later on to look old, because it's more convincing, sadly, to make a young person up as an old person than the reverse, as... Indiana Jones and The Dial of Destiny will attest to, which otherwise I think is a very good film. So I guess for me, the draw of the film is the complicated nature. We haven't talked about the massive spoiler, but I guess we're going to, except that it is a...
We will.
The draw to me is that I'm drawn in by the melancholy and the tragedy. I like a good tragedy. I like, as we talked about before, I like seeing the train coming towards a character and you just hoping somehow they'll dodge it, even though you know they won't. It's got to be a character you care about, though, which is why Uncut Gems failed for us.
But also, as we've said before, because it is intrinsic to his nature.
Yes.
The train is coming towards him because of who he is, and he has put it there.
Well, it has
And he had no choice but to put it there because of who he is.
It has some lovely lines along those lines, like, if I hadn't been incredibly rich, I really could have been a great man. I think I did pretty well under the circumstances. That sort of thing where everyone kind of knows that it's a tragedy. I just find it very sad and moving. I personally am moved. The whole, the death of his political ambitions where he's trying to, oust this very corrupt, New York, who again is based on a real political figure, I believe. And he just gets destroyed by this affair that he has. I'm moved by the story, and the more you find out about him. The acting, I think, is incredible. The story, the characters are three-dimensional in a way that we don't often get with films. They're complicated, not easily explained. Which I suppose is partly the point of the film, in that, the idea is that Rosebud is gonna, once you understand Rosebud, you'll understand Cain. And like a lot of things in the film, it's kind of true and it kind of isn't.
Well, I would argue that it isn't. I mean, there's that last speech of, we're never going to understand him, but if somebody had come along to them and pointed out this label, this is what Rosebud is, this is clearly what it represents, I don't think that actually helps you understand it much better.
No, but it sort of feels like it might. It sort of gives you an idea of like, oh, you were sad about it. But then you think about it more and think, yeah, but that doesn't... That ambiguity I like a lot about it.
A thing that struck me particularly was some stuff around
it's a sled, by the way.
Sally, the second wife, and this is presented by his enemies as here is a little Asian man screwing around with a much younger woman, but the way we see the meeting and the way they first talk, I think it's very much that he is just struck by the. Really a new thing to him of hearing somebody who doesn't know who he is, isn't awed by how much money he's got, to just, here's a guy with a dirty raincoat that he needs to get cleaned up.
And yet she's still sort of interested. That means any interest she shows in him is not because he's Charles Foster Kane.
Mm. Though, it's interesting, this is one of the things that Hearst was definitely concerned by, it was suggested that this was an expi of Marion Davis, his mistress at the time. But the impression I got, and obviously this wouldn't have happened at the time, because it hadn't happened yet, is much more Piers Adora, because Marion Davis was a competent actress.
Yes.
And she managed to continue to work even as Hearst's mistress. Whereas here what we've got is somebody who... She has no particular ambitions to be a big star. She is a singing teacher. That's about it. She's quite happy doing that. And Kane wants to make her the best singing teacher. And therefore she has to be a big opera star because that's how you be the best singer.
And that is not driven by any compassion for her. It's all about Kane, this thing.
I mean, it might start in, obviously she must want this because it's what everybody wants, to be the biggest and the best.
But once it's clear that she doesn't want to do it, he's going to do it anyway.
Mm.
I agree. Wasn't it also suggested by Gore Vidal that Rosebud was actually the name of Hurst's mistress's clitoris.
That sounds like a very gore vidal
thing to say. It does. I don't think it matters, but I agree. But I suppose that goes to the point of he's actually an amalgam of different characters and different stories, and I think it's that story, the Pisidora story, told well in the context of another man's life as well. I like the film. I don't.
Yeah. One thing I thought was interesting for context is The Grapes of Wrath. The novel came out in 1940.
Right.
So, or was it the film? Anyway, the story is in the public consciousness. And I think some of that may well have been that, as a result of that, that the hard-hitting story was to some extent in fashion.
Yes,
so okay. So that allows Wells to get away with perhaps more than he might have at a different time.
In a similar, like the kind of sad endings, miserable endings of the 60s and 70s, new wave kind of stuff.
Mm.
Possibly, yes. We haven't mentioned the marriage montage, which is another famous scene of the movement from happy marriage to we want to get a divorce in about 90 seconds, which is nicely done. I have to say, that's lauded as one of the greatest scenes of cinema. I think it's nicely done, but it doesn't speaking from someone who enjoys the narrative. It does the job, and I think it's very well done, but I don't find it one of the most moving or fascinating scenes of the film, just from an audience member.
But, I mean, let's also remember, this is only a couple of decades into the talkies. There are people who would remember when you had to do that with an intertitle.
And you could probably do it with a silent film as well, that sort of thing. Yeah, I mean, I feel I'm just gushing on Citizen Kane.
Yeah, I'm not going to gush. I did enjoy it. I will absolutely grant Masterpiece, even if I didn't think it worked, simply because of the degree to which it has been copied. Fair enough.
Mm.
I do think it works. I don't love it. I do get a certain amount of look at what I can get away with. But even so,
it has a slight feel to me of The Sweet Smell of Success. And I think maybe in retrospect, I probably admire Sweet Smell of Success more. What I mean by that is these are incredibly powerful figures in a way that don't quite exist anymore, although sadly newspaper magnates, or at least media magnates, still have quite a grip on our society, but not perhaps not quite the same grip as they used to, but that's only very recent. But these kind of unsympathetic characters with dimensions. I do prefer the process of watching Citizen Kane, I think, than Sweet Smell of Success, which I do think is a brilliant film as well.
I could see myself watching both of them again, though not immediately and not next to each other.
No, fair enough. First and foremost, despite all its technical wonders, despite the new things it was doing, I just find, as a narrative, which I think I am most interested in as a viewer, as a narrative, on an emotional level, it resonates with me. Therefore, I like it. And I was pleasantly surprised that a film that was supposed to be wonderful, and we have watched a number of films on Ribbon of Memes that are supposed to be wonderful, and it usually makes it like a film less to be. Well, I'm not sure that's quite true, but it sets you up in a different way. For some reason, The Artist is springing to mind, which I liked, but I didn't love. But it resonates for me on an emotional level. I as far as Masterpiece goes, I think it'd be pretty hard to argue it isn't. Personally, whether it's the greatest film of all time, it's an entirely subjective thing, but it doesn't really mean anything.
I don't think I'm ever going to love the film. I might eventually. You hear of people watching it four times in a row. That's not going to be me. There are definitely things that did work. I think on balance, it does work very well. It's not always pleasant. Not always comfortable. One could argue that that's a perfectly valid thing for a film not to be. And yeah, fair enough.
I can see, as a film student, it would massively reward rewatching and rewatching and writing theses of it in a way that the actual perfect film, Aliens, possibly doesn't, probably doesn't, you know. Aliens is not doing anything in it for that. But, by God, it's a really good film to watch. And Citizen Kane, which film would I rather watch? It's Aliens, if I'm going to watch. But I really, really like Citizen Kane. It's not my favourite film, personally. That doesn't mean it's not the greatest film of all time. I do think it was a shame that Orson Welles was never given the creative freedom again that he got here. There's moments of brilliance in his later films, like The Third Man. I'm not sure he's the best thing in The Third Man, but he's very good. Which we've also talked about in a previous episode. The Magnificent Ambersons is very good. And
Touch, I know somebody who's a great fan of F for Fake.
Yes, that is also very good. Touch of Evil he's in, which I like. I didn't love. Transformers the movie, which he's in. Before the Transformers movies were Michael Bay'd up to the Met. I think it's very good. I'm running out of things to say about it. Partially because I'm aware, you know, on a technical perspective, it's been done to death.
I think it's possibly worth mentioning the reception because, I mean, on the one hand, Hearst set out to ruin the careers of everybody involved in it because he felt it was an attack on him. And in turn, that obviously generated the sort of publicity that you can't afford. which certainly didn't hurt its long-term reputation.
It did.
Justified or not, it doesn't matter.
I think it's one of those films that was beloved of critics and then people went to see it and thought, oh. Which is a shame, but I can see why you would go and see it and think, ugh. So I don't know how well it did. I think it did okay at the box office. I don't think it did stellar.
Yeah. Not a complete flop like Casablanca, but...
I'd rather watch Casablanca as well. okay, well... Yeah, two thumbs up from us. Two masterpieces up from us. Keep it up, Orson Welles. Well done.
No, I'd just like to say in passing, I'm drunk.
If only.